Welcome to Politics 101 with David Orr, a podcast brought to you by Reform for Illinois. Joining me to question our guest today is Elisa Kaplan, who's Executive Director of Reform for Illinois. Our guest is Deborah Witzberg, a former prosecutor who has been with the OIG, that's the Office of Inspector General, since 2016 and served as Deputy IG for Public Safety before being appointed IG. That was back in 2022. She's up appointment sometime in the near future. And Deborah, I wasn't sure whether it was this year or next.
April of next year is the end of this year.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Elisa won that bet. Okay. Well, thank you for being here, Elisa and Deborah.
Thank you for having me.
Elisa, why don't you start it out?
Yeah, we'll get right into it. So, Deborah, thanks so much for being here. We've had you on the podcast before, but for those of our listeners who may not have heard that episode, can you give us an overview and maybe just a couple of sentences of what the IG's office is and its main functions?
Absolutely. OIG is an independent, nonpartisan watchdog agency in city government whose mission is to promote economy, effectiveness, efficiency, and integrity in the operation of city government. We conduct our oversight work in the service of that mission in three channels of work. The first is that we conduct administrative and criminal misconduct investigations when somebody in city government is accused of breaking the rules. The second is that we do program and policy work, which looks at whether programs and operations of city government are working as well as they should, whether they're working efficiently and effectively and so on. And the third channel of our work is transparency initiatives. This is work animated by the idea that information about the government belongs to the governed. And the focus of that work is to make information which is publicly available about city government meaningfully publicly accessible.
Great. And it's a lot of interesting things we could get into if we had the time, like some of the people that have done some bad things. And
I would have us here all week.
Okay, well, let's turn to the ongoing battles you're having with the mayor's office and particularly the Department of Law on several fronts, enough to make you say you often feel like you're hitting a brick wall on a regular basis. There's been a lot of coverage lately, which I think has been good for you. Jake Sheridan did an elaborate piece if people want to look into this on their own in the Tribune recently. Cranes has done some an article about this stuff. So it's out there. And in my nearly 40 years of political life in both the city and the county of Cook, it's not uncommon for a strong, aggressive IG, Inspector General, to bump heads with aldermen, mayors, other elected officials, particularly in a place with Chicago's reputation for corruption and inside dealing. So again, the ideal is a strong IG and a strong and open-minded mayor that sees both. So we're going to get into some of that stuff today. Let me just start with gifts, okay? The mayor's office updated its policy on public disclosure of gifts to the mayor after you raised the issue in January. What was remarkable, at least to me, was the administration's refusal to cooperate with your inquiry. What do you make of that conflict, and how do you assess the mayor's new policy on public disclosure and gifts?
That was remarkable to me, too. The law is very clear that the Office of Inspector General is entitled to access to all of the city's premises. And the mayor's use of the law department to block our access to an area in City Hall where unreported gifts were being stored was, I think, really alarming. You know, I talk a lot about what goes wrong in windowless rooms at City Hall. I usually mean that as a metaphor. This is a situation where there were gifts of value being given to and accepted by the mayor's office, literally behind closed doors in City Hall. And the mayor's office, by way of the law department, as you say, blocked our access to those. And I think that's very troubling. I think the lack of cooperation and the resistance to transparency and accountability efforts is really what is of most interest and most concern about that about that story.
Were you satisfied by the changes that the mayor's office made in its gift disclosure policy?
I think that there are positive changes. That's how oversight should work. It should be that we identify a problem, raise a set of concerns, and those concerns get addressed by policy change. That's there's certainly a there's I think if you look hard enough, you can find a good news story in this incident, which is that there were improvements to the policy. The fact of the matter is the mayor's office is now clearly obligated to comply with the same law that has applied to everybody else all along. And if there are additional improvements in transparency and public access as well, then that is better than not.
So you managed to get into the gift room, finally?
We were not ever permitted access to the gift room during the course of our investigation. The mayor's office has now made a gift storage area accessible to some people sort of by appointment. And in the interest of sort of safeguarding any future investigative work, I won't say too much more about this. I will say that the purpose of unannounced inspections is that they are unannounced.
Yeah, I was going to ask why is this important? Why was it important that you have access to the gift room? Why is it important that gifts are disclosed? Why should ordinary Chicagoans care about this issue?
Absolutely. That's a really good question. So the city's ethics ordinance sets out rules for the handling of gifts in city government, and that is to protect government actions, government decisions from improper influence. The idea is that gifts to government officials look an awful lot like bribes if they are not handled properly. And so the ethics ordinance gift rules are set up to guard against those situations where there is either an appearance or a reality, both of which are very damaging from a legitimacy perspective, of improper influence. And so that's why the gift rules matter. And the mayor's office has, we learned that the mayor's office had for many decades, long preceding Mayor Johnson, to be clear, going back to the administration of Eugene Sawyer, the mayor's office had been exempted from the regular public reporting rules around gifts accepted on behalf of the city, and instead had what they was described as an unwritten arrangement with the Board of Ethics. It's been my experience that in ethics enforcement, an unwritten arrangement is unlikely to be good news. They had an unwritten arrangement whereby instead of doing any public reporting of gifts, the mayor's office was to keep track in a physical log book, which was publicly accessible at City Hall. And so I sent undercover investigators to ask to see the log book. They were told that they couldn't see it. They would need to submit a Freedom of Information Act request. We did so without disclosing our identity as the sender of that request. The mayor's office never responded. Only then did we send a compelled OIG document request for information about the gifts. That's how we learned that these were being stored in what was described as a gift room. All of that is to say, gift rules matter because they're the safeguard against bribery. And if gifts are accepted on behalf of the city, they are by definition city property. They belong to the city of Chicago and its residents. And what was important about our undercover work here was that we were able to demonstrate that no member of the public had meaningful access to these gifts or to any information about them.
You've recently been focusing on how the city, the mayor's office, the law department in general have interfered with your ability to do your job, or at least to do your job as independently and effectively as you are supposed to be doing it. First of all, since this is politics 101, let's just back up for a second. And can you explain what is the city's law department and who do they work for?
That is a very good question and is maybe more complicated than might be ideal. The city's Department of Law is the entity set up to carry out the legal business of the city. And it is led by the city's Corporation Counsel, who is the city's chief legal officer. Now, as a matter of enabling authority and structure, the Corporation Council represents the municipal corporation, that is to say, the city of Chicago and its departments and officials, as well as certain individual city employees under certain circumstances. The law department, even under the best of circumstances, sometimes finds itself in complicated positions, like, for example, in cases of police misconduct, where the law department might both be the sort of prosecuting authority in a case, for example, before the police board, while also defending a police officer who is being sued arising out of the same incident of misconduct. So the structure of the law department provides for some complicated arrangements under the best of circumstances. But even leaving that aside, the practical reality is that the corporation counsel is functioning as the mayor's lawyer, which is different, I think, in purpose and priority from being the lawyer for the city of Chicago, for the municipal corporation. And I think that many of our current challenges really stem from that practical reality, which is that, you know, the interests that I think the law department is acting to protect are the mayor's.
Is that unique to Chicago, or is that an arrangement and a practice that you see in other jurisdictions as well, that commitment of the law department more to protecting the mayor, acting on behalf of the mayor rather than on city departments in general?
It's a really interesting question. We have not done any sort of, you know, broad comparative analysis. I will say it has not always been that way even here. So there was a period of time, not all of her time in office, but there was a period of time, for example, during Mayor Lightfoot's administration, when she had a chief counsel, she had an ethics counsel in the mayor's office who was explicitly the mayor's lawyer, right? And the advantage of that was that there wasn't even any appearance or suggestion or obligation that that person function as anything other than the mayor's lawyer. We are now in a very different place. And that leads to, as I say, I think our challenges around interference with OIG's work by the law department, which is, I think, very hard to read as anything other than interference with effective and independent oversight motivated by the interests of the mayor, because I think that those are the interests that the law department is working to protect.
Okay, so let's talk about more about this interference that you're talking about. You released a memo in February talking about several different types of interference and what can be characterized as obstruction, and making suggestions for how to fix these. For background, you referenced this earlier, but the ordinance that created your office requires city officials to cooperate with the inspector general in its investigations and says that each department's premises, equipment, personnel, books, records, and papers shall be made available as soon as practicable. It's clear from your memo that you don't believe the city has been living up to its obligations under that ordinance. And you focused on three practices that you think need to change. These can get a little legalese and technical, so we're going to do our best to untangle them and discuss them in layman's terms. The first has to do with the city not providing records you need for your investigations. The city, and this is the law department, to go back to who's responsible here, is claiming that they can't provide some of these records because of something called attorney-client privilege. Can you explain what attorney-client privilege is for those of us who aren't lawyers, and so we can understand why city lawyers think they can use it to justify withholding these records?
Yes. Well, I'm not sure I can get so far as to why they think that they can use it to withhold the records, but we can certainly talk about what.
We'll get to that in a few minutes. But just so people even understand what we're talking
about
here.
So attorney-client privilege broadly is the notion that communications between an attorney and their client are confidential and protected from disclosure to third parties. And the general principles there are, you know, to ensure that people are able to get candid and well-informed legal advice from their attorneys, and that is a confidential relationship. Now, attorney-client privilege, there's lots of law around the fact that attorney-client privilege works very differently in a government, in the context of government lawyers, than it does in a private sector setting. If an individual person goes out and hires a lawyer, that's a very clear relationship. There's an attorney and a client, and that relationship is very clear, and the rules around privilege are well established. It is much less clear in a government law setting for lots of different reasons. The fact of the matter is, when the law department asserts attorney-client privilege as a limitation on that duty to cooperate that you mentioned, they are doing so improperly. And that is for a number of reasons. And I'll just highlight two of them, which I think are most important. One is that in a conclusion that has gone all the way to the Illinois Supreme Court, the Office of Inspector General is not a separate legal entity from the city of Chicago. We are, in fact, part of the municipal corporation of the city of Chicago. The law department is, again, at least on paper, they're our lawyer too. We are the city. And so disclosure of records to us or production of records to us is not disclosure to a third party of the sort that is protected by attorney-client privilege. The second thing that I think is really important is that precisely this issue, the issue of offices of inspector general having access to materials which would otherwise be protected from third-party disclosure, is a battle that has been fought and won on the federal landscape. So federal inspectors general were having the same issues as we have had with the agencies they oversaw blocking their access to records. This whole thing went back before Congress, years after the Federal Inspector General Act had been signed into law. The federal IGs presented this problem. There was a clarifying piece of federal legislation, the Inspector General Empowerment Act, which said it was a clarification, explicitly a clarification, not a change to the law. And it basically said, look, when we said that the IGs get access to all the records, we meant they get access to all the records. And an agency does not get to assert privilege against itself, against its internal watchdog. And so that's the same principle here. And so I think, to be clear, and this is true with respect to the other changes that we'll talk about as well, but the changes we have proposed to Chicago's municipal code to deal with this attorney-client privilege issue would simply bring Chicago into line with those federal rules and with national standards. This is an issue that the International Association of Inspectors General, which is the sort of professional accrediting body, has spoken on. And Chicago is out of line with national standards on this issue.
So basically what you're saying is, it's one thing if, you know, I, as a regular person, am involved in some kind of lawsuit, and I want my conversations with a lawyer to be kept confidential. I don't want to, you know, that information to my lawyer to go out blabbing to the public about it, or, you know, to their friends at dinner. But that's a different situation from your office, as a city office, asking for information that might otherwise be considered privileged from another city department, essentially. Is that a fair characterization of what you're saying?
That might be considered privilege from third-party disclosure. So
right,
it might be
right.
Information that the city would not be obligated to disclose in a FOIA request, for example, or some other way, by way, you know, in terms of public disclosure. Mandated production to an internal watchdog is not third-party disclosure for purposes of attorney-client privilege. And that's the critical difference.
Yeah, you mentioned federal courts on this issue, and there is actually a great quote that you cited in your memo by a Seventh Circuit judge, said it would be both unseemly and a misuse of public assets to permit a public official to use a taxpayer-provided attorney to conceal from the taxpayers themselves otherwise admissible evidence of financial wrongdoing, official misconduct, or abuse of power. So essentially, you can't use this privilege to hide misconduct, which is,
I said it better myself.
Basically, right. Well, that's why you quoted it in your memo.
Yes.
Okay. So that's one of the issues that you brought up. Let's talk about the second. You said that the law department interferes with investigations by insisting on sitting in on some interviews with witnesses or subjects of your investigation. In some instances, you've even called this an egregiously obstructive practice. Can you talk a little more about that, about the city's practice and why that's a problem?
Yes, absolutely. Let me start with a couple of sort of first principles here. Our investigative work is confidential by law from everybody, including other city departments. while those investigations are being conducted. That's for all kinds of good and important reasons, including that people have, I think, frankly, well-founded fears about retaliation, and you know, being sort of punished in their city jobs for bringing a whistleblower complaint or for cooperating with OIG or whatever the case may be. Our investigations are confidential by law. Independence in the conduct of those investigations is the hallmark and the lifeblood of Inspector General work. That's how this works. We would not be much good as an independent watchdog if the mayor got to pick and choose whom we could investigate. So against that backdrop, the law department has selectively insisted or demanded to sit in on confidential OIG investigative interviews, and we have not allowed that to happen. To be clear here, the person being interviewed, whether that's a witness or a subject, is themselves entitled to have their personal lawyer in the room. They are entitled to have their lawyer there. The mayor is not entitled to have his lawyer there, and that is the critical difference. I think the best way to think about why this matters is that, you know, it is not a hypothetical situation where we might get a complaint, a whistleblower complaint about the mayor or against a senior member of the mayor's staff or whatever the case may be. I don't think that we can sensibly be expected to conduct a meaningfully independent and effective investigation if the expectation is that we are interviewing complainants or whistleblowers with the mayor's lawyer staring them down from across the table.
You spoke a little bit about the selectivity of those instances, how the law department often didn't ask to be included in these interviews, but sometimes it did. And that suggested to you that the motivation behind this practice was often political. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I think in any situation where the mayor's lawyers are selectively sort of attempting to reach into our investigations, we ought to be concerned about why that is. And the appearance of that to me is certainly that they are attempting to interfere with those investigations, which risk embarrassment to allies of the mayor or embarrassment to City Hall or whatever the case may be. That's not a world we can live in. One of the things we note is that the law department does not make a practice of, for example, demanding to sit in on interviews conducted by the police department's Bureau of Internal Affairs when they are interviewing police officers accused of doing something wrong. Now, those are acts of misconduct which present tremendous litigative risk to the city. All kinds of very serious misconduct gets investigated there. The law department does not make any regular practice of sitting in on those interviews. And so I think any suggestion that they're trying to kind of appropriately manage risk to the city fails. I think this is about protecting people whom they would rather not be subject to investigation.
And you cite a few examples in your memo. Only three examples in previous recent history of previous administrations where the law department demanded to be included. These were in the OIG investigation into a senior member of the Chicago Police Department leadership found sleeping at the wheel of his vehicle, his police vehicle, an OIG investigation regarding city employees' handling of the demolition of an industrial smokestack, and your investigation or your office's investigation into the city's handling of the CPD search of the home of Anjanette Young. Those, I think we all remember those very high profile cases. And how politically sensitive they became. So essentially, what you're saying is they're interfering in cases where the city is at risk for embarrassment or these more politically sensitive cases.
That's how it looks to me.
And it sounds from your account that there have been more and more of these demands recently. I mean, you only cited those three examples earlier, but there's been 10 more recent examples since you've been OIG. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think we have been more aggressive than this office has been historically, certainly in pursuing ethics investigations and in pursuing investigations of high-ranking city officials altogether. So I think that is one reason. I think the other important change, to be clear, is that during my tenure as Inspector General, we have not permitted the Law Department to sit in on these interviews. That did not used to be the case. Before I was Inspector General, this office did permit the Law Department to sit in on some of those interviews. And I've declined to do that.
So you talked about how all of this can interfere with you conducting thorough investigations, with the objectivity of the investigation and the ability of witnesses and subjects to speak freely. But you also talk a lot about how these practices are delaying your investigations. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why that is important, why that's a big problem?
Yeah. Well, timeliness is a tremendous challenge in this work. I am a recovering prosecutor. I know it in my bones to be true that cases do not improve with age. Evidence fades, memories fade. People are entitled to swifter resolution in matters of public concern. Timeliness is a tremendous challenge. Our cases already take, frankly, longer than they should. And in these situations where, in addition to doing the investigative work, which is our mission and our obligation to do, where we also are navigating these sort of roadblocks from the law department, it slows us down tremendously, and in some cases forecloses investigative avenues altogether. So because I have declined to do what I think would be compromising the independence and the confidentiality of our investigations by allowing the law department to sit in, there are just some avenues of investigation that are closed off to us altogether. There's just some evidence that we're either never going to get or we have to go about getting in a much more circuitous and time-consuming way.
Yeah, you discussed that in the context of the third practice that you focused on here, which is the enforcement of subpoenas. Can you, first of all, again, just tell us what a subpoena is and how you use them and what the law department's involvement with them is and what are some of the problems with the current practice?
Absolutely. A subpoena is an order to provide evidence of some kind. And the way we have legal authority to issue administrative subpoenas, that is to say, not a subpoena that comes from a court, but we have authority to issue administrative subpoenas ourselves. And we can do so either for testimony, we can send someone a subpoena and says, you have to show up at this date and time and answer our questions, or we can subpoena documents or records. And we use subpoenas for both of those things in the course of our investigative work. To get information from any person or entity who does not already have a duty to cooperate with us, but from whom we need information. And so that might be something as straightforward as, you know, phone records or bank records or, you know, that sort of documentary evidence, or it might be for testimony. And the way the municipal code is currently written, so we have authority to issue those subpoenas. And if we issue a subpoena and someone complies with it, then great. But if we issue a subpoena and someone does not comply, the next step, the reason subpoena power matters is because there's an enforcement mechanism. So we can sue in the Circuit Court of Cook County for enforcement of a subpoena. And that is a proceeding in which if someone persists in not complying, a judge can order them to comply. That's the teeth of subpoena power. And so the third concern that we raise has to do with the fact that the municipal code says that if we issue a subpoena and we need to sue to enforce it, the law department has to basically approve our ability to do that on a case-by-case basis. And my concern there is that the law department has read that provision to say that they can either approve our enforcement of a subpoena or not, depending on our answers to their questions about the underlying matter we are investigating. And I think the specter that raises is a similar one. The risk there is that if they think that we have issued a subpoena to investigate something which they don't want investigated, they can simply decline to permit us to enforce it.
And is that something that's happening frequently?
No. It's not something that's happening frequently. I think the risk with all of these practices, frankly, certainly with investigative interviews and with subpoena enforcement, has less to do with the frequency and more to do with the impact of the practice. So I, you know, again, the changes we have proposed with respect to subpoena enforcement, actually, the change we have proposed is simply to align OIG's subpoena enforcement abilities precisely with the ones that already exist for the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. The Law Department does not appear to have had any objections to those arrangements. That's how COPA has been operating for all of the years of its existence. I am frankly a little bit unclear on why it would be problematic for us to operate the same way that another city agency has been operating for all these years. In any event, these three sets of changes we've proposed, in my view, are again very clearly intended to align Chicago with national standards and with the federal rules, and to eliminate risk. Not to eliminate a problem that's occurring every day, but to eliminate risks, of what I think are profound and fundamental threats to our effectiveness and independence.
Thank you. I think that really helps us get to the bottom of again, some of these thorny and technical issues. So I think that was a really helpful overview, David.
Okay, I think now we're going to get into more of a, so what's happened with all this, and talk more about also the mayor's objections, some of his stated objections, and some of his allies. So Alderman Matt Martin, that you may know, is chair of the City Council's Ethics Committee. He's introduced ordinances based on your proposals, okay, on these issues,
Yes.
but it's been stalled. And part of the game in City Hall sometimes is to send bills that they don't like to Rules Committee. So Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez, who's a close ally of the mayor, when Matt Martin's ordinance came up, they sent it to Rules. Okay, where it's been kind of buried for a while. So the things that you've been talking about in great detail, we're still waiting to see, at least with the city council taking some action on it. All that same Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez basically accused Alderman Martin and your office of using these issues to attack the mayor politically before given an opportunity to work with you. Do you even want to respond to that or not? And then
I'll say this. These are issues that we have been raising with the Law Department since before Mayor Johnson took office. This issue did not is not new to Mayor Johnson's administration. So these are issues that we tried to work through during Mayor Lightfoot's administration. These are issues that I raised the day that I met with Mayor Johnson's transition team as he was coming into office in the hopes that we might be able to work through some solutions before any problems arose. And it's something which, in the intervening 2 years that he's been in office, we have been trying to work through with the Law Department and sort of by extension or by proxy, the mayor's office. So this is not oversight by ambush here. These are issues we've been talking about for a long time. And I continue to be really hopeful that given clarity around the problems and what we're trying to do here, that Mayor Johnson will support the reforms that we're proposing. I think worth saying two things that have happened since Chairman Martin introduced the ordinance which proposed these changes. The first is that Chicago's Better Government Association, which I know you and many of your listeners will be familiar with, commissioned and published a legal opinion affirming the viability of these proposals. So one of the things that the Law Department has said is that this proposed ordinance would conflict with some existing law. And we now have what I think is a very helpful and clarifying independent legal opinion that says that that is not the case and that there is no legal obstacle to the changes proposed in the ordinance. I think that's helpful and important. The other, I think, critically important recent development is that the Association of Inspectors General, which we talked a little bit about, it's the sort of international professional organization of inspectors general, has issued position papers on the issue of agency lawyers being present in investigative interviews and assertions of attorney-client privilege, which are very clear statements of professional and national standards on these issues, which precisely align with our identification of the issues and with our proposal of solutions. And so now that, we've sort of, I think we've eliminated any concern that there's a legal obstacle to these changes, and we have very clear statements of national standards on these issues, I'm really hopeful that Mayor Johnson will support the ethics reforms.
you're not alone in raising complaints about the mayor's seeming lack of interest in issues of ethics. Ethics Committee Chair Matt Martin told the Tribune he's had to fight tooth and nail for just the bare minimum in ethics just to maintain the status quo. Our own organization, Reform for Illinois, has noted Johnson's resistance and said it should not be this hard to pass the most basic ethics fixes. And the BGA has accused the mayor of outright hostility to ethics reform. Mayor Johnson, for his part, has criticized his critics on ethics. He told the Tribune that the ethics or ethos of government cannot just be simply mired in our conversation around the potential to corruption. Quote, I find that to be a very puerile sort of approach toward how we talk about ethics. Ethics is about how we equitably distribute government in a way that everybody can feel proud of. So we have one hand, if I'm simplifying it, where the the mayor is saying that we need, quote, more equity, which I'm not sure who would disagree with. And the other side talking about transparency and accountability on ethical behavior and misbehavior, et cetera. How do you view the way these two elements work together?
I think it is a deeply false dichotomy to suggest that we can either pursue equity or ethics in government. I think that is a deeply false dichotomy. I think that for generations, the city of Chicago has operated at a tremendous deficit of legitimacy with its residents. And the only way we can operate a government which looks more like the one Chicagoans deserve is to pay down that deficit. I have a lot of trouble reconciling the idea that the pursuit of equity in city services requires an abandonment of transparency and accountability. That just doesn't speak to me. I will say, I think, you know, I have given, and apologies if we've talked about this before, but I have given a lot of thought to the fact to how much resistance there is around ethics reforms, around meaningful change on government ethics. And I do think that change is hard. And it is particularly hard to make structural changes to the way things have always been done in situations like this. If we are really going to do that, if we're serious about reform, if we're serious about change, you know, the famous like notion of whether Chicago is ready for reform. If in fact we are ready for reform, and we're going to start to change things, change the way things have always been done, that means we actually have to change the way they are being done. And that means that someone is going to be the first person to get jammed up for doing things the way they have always been. And that feels really unfair to the people involved. And I candidly, on a human level, totally understand that. I think that when business as usual stops being tolerated, there's the first person who gets caught in the switch. And I think on a human level, again, I think that feels unfair. And I think that's where we are.
Let me just give the example, because I would say that I find it troubling to act like, you know, a good progressive mayor works on equity and these other things are not important. Okay. The BGA vice president said, well, I think the mayor of the city of Chicago should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Let me give an example back from Harold Washington. Who I respected, and with his help, we passed the first ever ethics ordinance in Chicago, at least of any substantive nature. Harold, very briefly, had been, very much committed to equity, and in a much more unequal time back when he was mayor than currently Mr. Johnson is. But that did not stop him. And one interesting thing about that, partly politically, is that many of the people on Harold Washington's side went to jail. Okay, unfortunately, you know, did go to jail. But so Harold not only was pushing equity, but he convinced these aldermen, and all I'm trying to say is that these aldermen were not really in favor of ethics, but he forced them or encouraged them or led them, whatever, to pass this first very strong ethics ordinance. Okay. And that to me is kind of the best practical example. So again, I too find it difficult. Of course you want the equity.
I think David,
go ahead.
That Mayor Washington probably understood what I think Deborah and certainly us at Reform for Illinois try to emphasize as well, that not only are they not mutually exclusive, but they're inseparable. Because when you talk about fighting corruption and when you talk about ethics, what you're talking about is making sure that, you know, Deborah talked about bribery, making sure that resources, city resources, for example, go to where they're needed, instead of going to the person who can pay the most, whether that's, you know, a bribe or a big campaign finance donation or whatever it might be. So it sounds like Mayor Washington understood that perfectly.
Right. Good. Very good point. I mean, all these years of patronage, for a quick example, we need to move on, is that when lots of minorities, for example, in the city were not being hired, okay, people talk about equity, but that was not equity. That was flat out corruption, favoritism, rules that later became legal responsibilities that Deborah and other IGs have been working on to stop the patronage abuses. We mentioned earlier, and you corrected me, that the appointment is actually next year. It could always come earlier because there's a process of going through city council, et cetera. But do you have any two cents, Deborah? A lot of people in the city believe you certainly deserve it because of your work, but what's your two cents?
I have at least two cents about that. well, I'll say this quickly. We've done some work on terms. I fought very hard to implement term limits for this position for myself. This is a job that should have term limits for all kinds of reasons. And so we got that done. And now for the first time, the Inspector General is limited to service of two terms, which is a good and important thing. I would like to serve a second term. I will say I have always been of the belief that you have to do this job like you don't want it anymore. We cannot pull punches to curry favor in the hopes of securing a reappointment. I'm satisfied that we are not pulling punches. I'm satisfied that I've done this job like I don't want it anymore, but I do. I believe in this work, and I hope to continue to do it. I hope to serve a second term. And I think that a reappointment decision that was made on the merits of the work that we have done would allow me to keep doing the job.
Okay, well, on behalf of Lisa and I and Reform for Illinois, Deborah Witzberg, we appreciate all you're doing and some of the, I know there's a little complicated issues in your dealings, but thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me.
That concludes this episode of Politics 101 with David Orr. You can find this episode and other past Politics 101 episodes on RSS.com, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Stay tuned for future episodes, and thank you for listening.